This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Brazil's top military leaders are stepping down in protest, creating a rupture between the president and the military.
I am extremely concerned about the future of democracy in Brazil. This is, in my view, a manufactured crisis.
Also today in France, some COVID backlash and a growing protest movement to bring back the theater.
It's necessary. You know, yesterday there were people that came and they had tears in their eyes and they were like, I never realized how much I missed it.
And we meet a stand-up comic in India who found a new audience during the pandemic. Sitting at home, he did what the kids do, tapped into technology and new audiences.
You know, young comedians have it really, really good in India right now.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. It's a tough time in Brazil right now. To put things mildly, nearly 3,800 people there died from COVID-19 in the past 24 hours, a new record in that country. And as if that wasn't bad enough, Brazil is now in the midst of what many are calling its worst military crisis since the 1970s. Back then, Brazil was ruled by a military dictatorship. This week's crisis was prompted by a major reshuffling of President Jair Bolsonaro's cabinet. From southern Brazil, Michael Fox has the latest.
Unprecedented. That's the word being used to describe the military crisis unfolding in Brazil. On Tuesday, the heads of the Brazilian Navy, Army, and Air Force jointly handed in their resignations in protest to President Jair Bolsonaro's removal of Defense Minister Fernando Azevedo e Silva amid a major government shakeup. Bolsonaro pushed out six leading members of his cabinet on Monday. Half of the replacements are centrists. The other half are longtime Bolsonaro loyalists. Brazilian political scientist Luciano da Hoz says it's a power move to place the military, police, and his liaison with the judicial system more firmly under his control. He says Bolsonaro made concessions to the centrist political forces in order to do what he really wanted, to double down on the strengthening of the coercive capacity of the government, not the state, but the Bolsonaro government. That point is key.
And in fact, we know that the reshuffling of the cabinet and the firing of some members of the armed forces, including the Secretary of the Minister of Defense, were done because Bolsonaro expected from them the total submission. I mean, he sees the army, as he has called it, quote unquote, his army, rather than a state institution.
That's Federico Finkelstein, an Argentine historian who has written extensively about fascism and populism in Brazil and Latin America.
I am extremely concerned about the future of democracy in Brazil. This is, in my view, a manufactured crisis from a leader that expects a kind of anti-democratic submission to the president from the armed forces.
Bolsonaro is a former military captain who served under the dictatorship that ran from 1964 through 1985. The Brazilian military is a major force in Bolsonaro's government, both in his coalition and among top cabinet officials. He has more than at any point since the dictatorship. His vice president, General Hamilton Mourão, served in the Brazilian army for almost five decades. We don't know exactly what happened to spark the ouster of the defense minister and the defection of the heads of the armed forces. But Lucas Rezende, a professor at the Federal University of Santa Catarina, says there is one clear hypothesis.
Most likely what he ordered the military commanders was something like putting the military on the streets in these states or cities that the governors or the mayors decided on some kind of local social restrictions.
Bolsonaro has fought local and regional lockdowns since the beginning of the pandemic.
Agora, o terreno fértil para a ditadura é exatamente a miséria, a fome, a pobreza.
That's him, a week and a half ago, telling supporters that social restrictions from local authorities were paving the way for a dictatorship by pushing the country towards social crisis. The moment will come, he said. I hope it doesn't, but the moment will come. Bolsonaro's congressman's son Eduardo took to social media over the weekend to encourage police riots against governors who adopt social isolation measures. This week, one of Bolsonaro's top allies in Congress proposed to fast-track a bill that, if approved, would give the president exceptional powers to combat the pandemic with force. It was overwhelmingly rejected. Opposition parties called it an attempted coup. All of this comes amid today's anniversary of the coup d'etat, which sank Brazil into a military dictatorship.
Atenção, Brasil! As tropas do segundo exército!
On March 31st, 1964, the Brazilian military overthrew the president, starting a military regime that would last for 2 decades. Hundreds were disappeared, thousands were imprisoned. Roughly 30,000 were tortured, according to a 2007 report from a government commission investigating state crimes. But after taking power in 2019, Bolsonaro called on his supporters to commemorate the date with fireworks and celebrations. Several are planned to take place today. That's Bolsonaro celebrating in Brasilia in 2019 in a video montage shared over Twitter. He says, this is the date the military saved Brazil from becoming another Cuba. March 31st is our day of freedom. Bolsonaro's new defense minister issued an official note last night calling on the population to, quote, understand and celebrate today's anniversary. The timing here is no accident, says Professor Hezengi.
There is absolutely and certainly a connection between the celebration of the coup d'etat in 1964 and the timing Bolsonaro decided to ask the armed forces to do what shouldn't be done by the Constitution. Bolsonaro has long and many times repeated how he misses the dictatorship and how the dictatorship was too soft.
Hezengi's outlook for the coming months is bleak. He believes we could either see a coup by the military against Bolsonaro, a Bolsonaro authoritarian power grab if he can force the military to his will, or Bolsonaro's own impeachment. Other analysts point out that the resignations of top military officials are an important sign that Bolsonaro is losing support from the armed forces just a year and a half from the country's next presidential election. But while this may be a sign of weakness, this is also a moment of crisis in politics, in the military, and the health system, with the still uncontrolled spread of COVID-19. For The World, I'm Michael Fox in Florianópolis, Brazil.
Brazil's latest surge has pushed the national death toll past 300,000, with daily deaths surpassing the rest of the world. Hospitals are on the brink of collapse.
Overall, it's the worst situation possible, and unfortunately, we're not seeing a lot in terms of trying to contain this.
Marcia Castro is a Brazilian demographer and chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at Harvard.
So the question is, what went wrong?
Castro says Brazil was ready for outbreaks. The country has a history of successful mass vaccine campaigns.
This is really a story about failed government leadership. It neglected science. It minimized the importance of the virus. It did not use the key advantage Brazil had, a universal healthcare system and a large and organized network of primary care.
Instead, the government promoted unproven treatments, misinformation. It did not plan ahead to secure vaccines and adopted a strategy to just let the virus spread. She says now, with a more contagious variant on the rise, it may be time for the world to step in and help Brazil, providing more vaccines.
If Brazil is about to become a global threat, then either we try to do something in an emergency basis in trying to alleviate what's happening in Brazil right now, or everybody could take a little share of this problem.
But it's not just Brazil that has experienced problems. The United States had led the world in pandemic preparedness. Castro says it all paints a difficult lesson that must not be forgotten moving forward.
When we tell the story about this pandemic, there's going to be a very important chapter about how bad leadership destroyed the opportunities, the advantages that countries had to respond to a pandemic.
Castro spoke with The World this week as part of our ongoing collaboration with Harvard's School of Public Health. View the full conversation at theworld.org. In Lebanon, the pandemic has been just one of many problems there this year. There was also the giant explosion at the port in Beirut on August 4th. And well before that, political instability and an economy in freefall. Now, Lebanon may be approaching a total collapse, and the nation's leaders seem to be doing little about it. Rebecca Collard has our report from Beirut.
This is becoming an all-too-common scene in Lebanon, people fighting over groceries in a supermarket. In this video posted by a local TV station, a crowd gathers as two women in an upscale grocery store curse at each other. They are fighting over subsidized food. Lebanon's currency, the lira or pound, has lost 80 or 90% of its value in the last 18 months. That means the cost of almost everything is shooting up dramatically. Government subsidies have helped make basic goods like flour, cooking oil, and fuel affordable, even for poor families. But those measures are likely to end soon, and people are trying to stockpile the subsidized goods. At the same time, banks have frozen the accounts of most ordinary Lebanese people. The signs of economic collapse are everywhere.
I'm at this major intersection just near my house, and half the time now, the traffic lights in this intersection just don't work. There's no lights whatsoever to guide the traffic. There's six roads going in and out of this intersection, and the drivers are essentially left to negotiate this intersection by themselves. You can hear them, they're using their horns to try to indicate where they're going. And of course, this is causing chaos, and this is something that we have in intersections across Beirut.
There are three banks here at this intersection. They've got modern storefronts with tall glass windows, but all of them are now protected by thick sheets of metal. Ahmed Saeed is on his way to buy art supplies. I ask him,
why are these banks covered in metal sheets now?
Because during the demonstration, people trying to attack the bank, because banks are responsible. They are part of the system that's stealing people money. For example, you have an account with a dollar. You are forbidden to get your own money.
Last year, the banks became a target of Lebanon's protesters who smashed their windows and lit several on fire. That's because Lebanese banks played a major role in bringing the economy here to its knees.
I'm in a small shop near my house that sells basic groceries and cleaning supplies. And they're in the process of putting up the price of the goods in the shop, basically taking off the old price and putting the new prices. And this is something that you see almost every day now in Lebanon. 1 year ago, how much was this?
Maybe 2,000, 2,500, and today is 6,000.
So more than doubled.
Yes, more.
Earlier this week, Lebanon's Speaker of Parliament described the country as sinking like the Titanic. It was an urgent call to action for the government. But the political leadership here is still squabbling, with different factions trying to protect their own power. That's according to Nizar Ghanem from the Triangle think tank in Beirut.
Lebanon requires an independent government to implement a strong reform plan to meet the conditions of international donors, especially like the IMF.
But there is no reform plan in place, and it's the poorest in Lebanon who are paying the highest price. More than half the population is now believed to be below the poverty line, with half of those people at risk of going hungry. The government has been unable to deliver most basic services. Even in the center of Lebanon's capital, people who depend on public electricity go almost 20 hours per day without power. But Nizar Ghanem says he still hopes the crisis can bring real political change and maybe an end to the sectarian system of governance that has been in place since the end of Lebanon's civil war, a system he says is the root of the problem.
The question now, the burning question for activists is how to organize to forge a new Lebanon out of this crisis. Because the crisis will pass, but Lebanon will not. It will stay. So it's up to us, in a sense, to figure our own agency and our own path.
Back at the intersection, Ahmed Saeed tells me he's not very optimistic about the country's political leaders rising to the occasion.
They're killing us slowly and very sadistic way. I think they're using that people will stay poor. This will keep them busy to get their basic need and stop thinking about making any political change. So keep them hungry. They will keep thinking about their food, and they will not asking for change in political way.
Protesters are back in the streets of Lebanon, but in much smaller numbers than before. A year and a half of demonstrations has brought little real change. The same ruling elite is still in power. Prime Minister Saad Hariri, who stepped down in the early days of the protests, is back, trying to form a new government. But many people here say they don't believe it's possible for Hariri or any of those in power to lead the country out of this crisis. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. The U.S. and Iran just can't reach an agreement over how to even talk about an agreement. I'm talking about the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. The Trump administration pulled out of it. The Biden White House now wants more concessions from Iran before re-entering it. But Iran doesn't like those terms. And round things go. Daryl Kimball is the executive director of the Arms Control Association in Washington. Daryl, what's the holdup here?
Well, both sides seem to want the same end goal, which is a return to compliance by the United States and Iran with that 2015 deal, which rolled back Iran's nuclear capacity substantially. But Iran has, over the last year and a half, retaliated by increasing its nuclear capacity in retaliation for Donald Trump's unilateral withdrawal from the agreement and the imposition of additional sanctions. So it is a difficult puzzle for both sides to solve. Iran has said that there is no need for a meeting and detailed negotiations. The United States simply needs to waive the sanctions that it had earlier committed to waive. And when the United States does, Iran says that it will reverse the actions that it has taken to exceed the limits set by the deal.
It's kind of interesting because, of course, the Obama administration originally negotiated this deal and Joe Biden was vice president then. So why won't the Biden administration simply recommit to it?
Well, they have recommitted, I think, to returning to compliance. The question is over the sequencing of the steps. We have to keep in mind that, you know, Iran has a number of actions that it will need to take to return to compliance that will take several weeks, not too long. They'll have to reduce the amount of enriched uranium they have stockpiled. They'll have to remove some of the advanced centrifuges they've installed that they were not supposed to under the deal. There are a number of other things they'll have to do. The United States will have to unwind the very complex set of sanctions that the Trump administration put back in place. And Iran is, I think, interested in a compliance for compliance type of arrangement by which both sides agree to do everything more or less at once. Iran is eager to have these sanctions lifted. It's creating enormous and economic pain for the people.
President Biden campaigned on re-entering the deal with Iran. Do you think he's still committed?
I think he's still committed, but I don't think that he is putting enough diplomatic energy behind this right now. I think he may believe that there is more time to reach an agreement with Iran about mutual re-entry with the 2015 deal than there actually is. This should be one of his highest diplomatic priorities right now, because if this 2015 deal completely unravels, Iran will very likely increase its production of enriched uranium. They'll put more advanced uranium centrifuges in place, and this will become much more difficult to achieve, especially if hardliners are elected to the leadership in Iran in their June election. So this is the time in the next 2 to 3 weeks to really bear down and reach a comprehensive understanding with Iran about returning to compliance.
Daryl Kimball is the executive director of the Arms Control Association. He's been speaking to us from Washington. Thanks a lot, Daryl.
Thank you.
It's been more than a year since cultural spaces across the U.S. closed their doors to try and curb the spread of COVID-19. In France, it's been a similar story, but many artists are now fighting back. They say it's time to reopen, and they're occupying dozens of theaters across the country to make their point. Rebecca Rossman reports from Paris.
For the first time in over a year, I'm walking into a theater, the Odeon Theater on the left bank of Paris. Inaugurated by Marie Antoinette in 1782, it's one of the most recognizable cultural lieux in the entire city. But the stage I'm looking at has been dark for the better part of the last year, literally.
Voilà, bon là c'est dans le noir, mais...
Denis Gravoui opens a door that overlooks the main stage, but you can hardly make out the white curtain. Gravoui is the Secretary General of CGT Spectacle, a cinematography and audiovisual trade union. He's one of some 40 people working in France's cultural sector who have been staging an illegal sit-in at this theater for nearly a month. The lobby is draped with union flags and cartoons poking fun at the French government. Air mattresses take up parts of the marble floors. One corner is dedicated to making protest signs. The Odeon is one of nearly 100 publicly owned cultural spaces being occupied as part of a demand to, quote, reopen culture.
C'est juridiquement possible, politiquement, qu'un artiste appelle la police pour déloger.
Sure, it's legally possible for the direction to make us leave, but it's not exactly a good look for an artist to kick out other artists, Clavry says. Tensions have been building between the government and the thousands of artists across the country who have been out of work since the start of the pandemic. Actors, musicians, technicians, sound engineers, many of these people work under a special status called intermittent, which takes into account the irregular nature of their work. During the off-season, France's 250,000 intermittents received generous unemployment benefits, equivalent to about half their regular monthly salaries.
Par exemple, on sait que les musiciens, ils ont perdu la moitié de leur revenu.
But Clavoui says those benefits aren't enough to live on and is calling for them to be increased and expanded. The occupants also say cultural spaces should be allowed to reopen with proper social distancing and mask wearing. When asked about reopenings earlier this month, France's culture minister Roselyne Bachelot said the government shared their eagerness.
Évidemment, nous faisons tout pour que la réouverture puisse se passer dans les meilleures conditions.
But with hospitals at overcapacity and the new coronavirus variant spreading, she said now is not the right time. Every afternoon, people gather on the large terrace in front of the Odeon Theater for what's called an agora, a free performance organized by the protesters. Today, it's a group of female percussionists. Filmmaker Valerie Massadian says culture is something that should belong to everybody.
It's necessary. You know, yesterday there were people that came and they had tears in their eyes and they were like, I never realized how much I missed it.
The government recently announced an extra 20 million euros in support for cultural workers, but actress Annabelle Gauthier says politicians are still missing the bigger picture.
Il y a un mépris total des politiques parce que eux-mêmes sont des générations à ne plus s'y intéresser avec les nouvelles technologies.
The way artists are being treated right now says a lot about the world we are living in, she says, one where screens are more important than physical gatherings. But she says that's not the right direction. For The World, I'm Rebecca Rossman in Paris.
Connect with the stories and the reporters who bring them to you by following us on Twitter. It's an easy one to remember. We're at The World. You're listening to The World. In the West African nation of Ghana, a push for LGBTQ progress was quickly shut down. The backlash from anti-gay politicians was harsh, but many queer Ghanaians are standing their ground.
That unapologetic gayness, unapologetic queerness is really coming to the forefront.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Institutional racism is not a problem in Britain. That's the conclusion of a new report released by the British government today. The review was commissioned after the Black Lives Matter protests in the UK last summer. But as the World's Orla Barry reports, activist groups are calling the newly released findings a whitewash.
As people marched through the streets of US cities last year in protest against police violence, hundreds of thousands also came out here in Britain to show solidarity.
We are a physical representation of our support for George Floyd.
Bang on them! Bang on them!
We are a physical representation and our support for Sandra Bland.
Bang on them!
We are a physical representation and our support for Trayvon Martin.
They were among the biggest protests seen in the UK in years. And it wasn't just about police killings of black people in the US.
You know, one of the biggest problems that we have in the UK is that we've never confronted our past in terms of empire and imperialism.
Charmaine Lovegrove is with Dialogue Books, a publisher of minority voices in Britain. Lovegrove took part in the Black Lives Matter marches in Bristol with her son last summer.
And so what we hear is a total ignorance around what happened during slavery and colonial times. For me, it was really important to go on that march because we've been marching and protesting for the freedom and equality and equity of black people for hundreds of years.
Following the marches, the UK government commissioned an independent review to investigate the extent of racism in Britain. Today, Dr. Tony Sewell, who led the investigation, says they found some evidence of racism in Britain, but not of institutional racism, he told the BBC.
We found anecdotal evidence of this. However, what we did find was the evidence of actual institutional racism. No, that wasn't there. We didn't find that in our report.
Family influence, socioeconomic background and religion, Sewell says, all had a much greater impact on people's life chances than racism. Race equality campaigners and activists have reacted with fury. Here's Charmaine Lovegrove again.
Our experiences that we've had from 450 years of slavery through to 250 years of colonialism that stem into modern day institutional racism have been completely whitewashed as if we were just making it all up. And I just feel absolutely shocked to my core.
The report claims that the UK has a more open society today, that children from many ethnic communities perform as well, if not better, than their white counterparts in schools. Kayende Andrews, Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University, says he simply doesn't know how they come up with these findings.
The way that they've butchered and misused the educational statistics to make it look like there's no racism is so... It's basically, to come to the conclusions they have come to, they are either liars or they're fools.
And for years, equality campaigners have pointed the finger at the healthcare sector as being one of the areas where structural racism exists. For example, black women are four times more likely to die in childbirth than white women in the UK. There are 24 recommendations in the report, from improving training for police officers to teaching what they call an inclusive curriculum in schools. Kayende Andrews says there's nothing new in any of the suggestions. One upside, though, he says, is that Britain's black communities now know exactly where the government stands when it comes to racism.
Well, I think in some ways, it's refreshing to just hear it and to hear it really clearly, because I think one of the things that happens with race relations is that they've been saying the same thing really for a long time, but just in more subtle ways. At least it is very open and we're not pretending.
While Andrews is dismissive of the new report on racism, he also worries that it'll be used by corporations and institutions as an excuse to avoid the issue altogether.
One of the things that definitely shifted, at least for a moment after last summer, was that corporations, big businesses, institutions at least had to talk about racism. But when you have a report like this from the government, it gives a legitimacy to it, which will say, actually, no, we don't need to bother with this Black Lives Matter agenda anymore. We can just move on.
One of those welcoming the review today was the Prime Minister. In a statement, Boris Johnson said the government is fully committed to building a fairer Britain and taking any action needed to address disparities wherever they exist. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
Comedians are not funny in isolation. They need an audience. For Indian comedian and actor Veer Das, that has meant some serious workarounds during the pandemic. Last year, he did 30 shows from lockdown in Mumbai via Zoom to raise money for COVID relief.
Good evening and welcome to what promises to be
the strangest stand-up comedy gig that you and I have both ever been a part of.
These days, Viridas is out of lockdown and on a film set. He's been cast in Judd Apatow's latest film, The Bubble. It's currently shooting in London, which is where I caught up with him. Viridas, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
You spent 8 months last year in a very small bubble in your apartment in Mumbai, doing shows via Zoom to benefit COVID relief. The result of that is your latest Netflix special, Viridas Outside In, the lockdown special. What was it like doing a show like that?
It was terrible. I'm going to be honest. You know, it's kind of like asking how sexting compares to sex. You know, it's technology. I did it because my wife and I just kind of realized how lucky we were to have the kind of lockdown that we did. And India went through various levels of crises at that time. There was not just a PPE crisis or, you know, a healthcare worker crisis, but we went through a migrant worker crisis as well. I feel like celebrities aren't often enough held accountable for how they can weaponize their following or weaponize their fan base beyond donating money, personally donating. You can actually use it to raise money. That can be a revenue source.
Did seeing your audience as individuals in those little Zoom boxes, did it change the way you thought of them?
It did. It made me appreciate them a lot more because, you know, usually when you come out and see my show, I'm under lights and you're this mass of people who's just in the dark, you're unlit. And then all of a sudden, I can see your house and I can see your bed and I can see the painting on your wall. That kind of dictated the comedy format. Instantly, I kind of realized, okay, this can't just be me talking and me telling jokes. This now has to be a conversation about them, because otherwise we're pretending like something doesn't exist. You know, both boxes are equal size on Zoom, me and them. So the show kind of has to be equally democratic.
You've been doing comedy in India for almost 20 years, but you grew up mostly in Nigeria and you went to college in the U.S. How do those really varied experiences inform your work?
I think I've just been a perpetual outsider. I grew up in Africa where I was the Indian kid, and then I went to boarding school and college in India where I was the African kid, and then came to college in America where I was the guy from New Delhi and from Delhi University, went to Bollywood where I'm the guy from American drama school, and I'm now working in America where I'm the guy from Bollywood. So I've lived everywhere, but I don't belong anywhere. And so you immediately adopt this outsider's perspective where you get to maybe examine a culture or a people without agenda, and where the agenda isn't integration. And I think that gives you a cool perspective.
It's interesting. In recent months, you've been doing a series of stand-up performances outside in India called 10 on 10, about 10 topics in the world. A few months ago, you did a gig in a forest in Goa in southern India. It was about religion and comedy. Here's a bit from it.
But I do not believe that there are multiple religions. I believe that there is one God, and she was like a single woman. And she was just dating. You know, she got onto like God, Tinder, Ginder, Gumble, whatever the hell that is. And she went out on multiple dates with multiple prophets. That's how it happened. She said the exact same thing to every single prophet. Exact same thing, but because they were men, they understood different and wrote different down, and that became religions. That's all religion is. It's mansplaining. Trust me, I know what I'm talking about. I'm a man.
But seriously, it seems like there is more and more religious sensitivity and heavy-handedness in India in recent years, especially among Hindu nationalists. How do you deal with that as a comedian?
I don't. They kind of deal with me. There's enough people to get upset at a religious joke, but there's also enough people to get upset at any joke in India right now. We're living in a bit of a sensitive time. So you just kind of have to power through. The only way is through. But I want to be clear that I do religious jokes as a religious man, and I talk about God as a God-fearing man. So my connection with God is one way, as yours should be, not crossing wires with mine. That's the way I maintain it.
You've been doing comedy in India since 2003. How has the stand-up scene changed or evolved or developed in those years?
Well, I think it's now a legitimate career option. It's a viable career. You know, when I showed up in 2003, people were like, what? You want to tell jokes for money? That seems insane, and still does to some people. But we have the largest audience watching content in the world. You know, young comedians have it really, really good in India right now. There are comedians getting millions of views 3, 4, 5, 6 years into stand-up, where it takes American comedians or British comedians, you know, 20 or 30 years to get those kind of views. So it's actually a very good place to do stand-up right now.
You have a real sort of casualness, a real candor that I associate with American stand-up. And I know you got your start in comedy as an undergraduate at Knox College. What drew you to comedy?
I think it was more rebellion to theater, I'll be honest. I just went through 4 years of drama school just doing, you know, Shakespeare and Chekhov and with American teachers saying things like emote with your shoulders and you know, just drama school stuff. And I was just kind of looking for a stage art form that was more organic and more free and more honest. So when I was in my senior year, I wrote a show, which was terrible, as all new shows must be. But I kind of got hooked. You know, once that bug bites you and you feel what it's like to even for a fleeting second be completely yourself on a stage, that's addictive at another level.
Veerdas is an Indian comedian, an actor. His latest Netflix special is called Veerdas Outside In, the lockdown special. You can find his 10-on-10 stand-up performances online, and you will be able to see him in Judd Apatow's next film called The Bubble. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
President Biden is in Pittsburgh today, unveiling a $2 trillion plan to revamp America's infrastructure and economy, investing in everything from bridges to roads to utilities. His administration is framing the 8-year spending plan as a program to create jobs, promote racial equity, and tackle the climate crisis. The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler has more.
If President Trump's rallying cry was America first, this infrastructure plan screams something more like, we'd better catch up. In a briefing document, the administration outlines how the U.S. is lagging behind other industrialized nations on a host of metrics. The quality of airports and infrastructure, research and development funding, electric vehicle manufacturing, and traffic fatality rates. It frames tackling climate change as a way to create jobs, and it stresses the need to outcompete one specific country, China.
I think it's pretty incredible that President Biden has framed his new infrastructure plan as a race against China.
Angel Hsu is an assistant professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. She recently testified at a Senate hearing about China's dominance in clean energy.
They are eating our lunch when it comes to clean energy investment in every regard in terms of solar and wind and hydropower and also electric vehicles.
For example, Hsu says China currently produces almost all of the world's electric buses. She hopes the emphasis on beating China on this front will foster a sense of healthy competition.
I think that whatever helps to galvanize people, to get people excited, particularly industry, I think that that's just helpful in the fight against climate change.
The Biden administration's plan includes more than $600 billion in spending on transportation infrastructure. More than a quarter of that would be earmarked for electric vehicle spending to, quote, win the market. Right now, roughly 3 times as many electric vehicles are sold in China each year as in the U.S., fueled by massive government investment. Scott Kennedy is an expert on Chinese business and economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
It's going to be impossible for the U.S. to ever try and match the Chinese in terms of government spending relative to the size of the market. But the U.S. certainly can do a lot more in terms of making smarter investments.
By that, he means steps that can boost demand in the U.S. for electric vehicles.
You need to have ubiquitous charging, and it needs to be fast. In addition, you need to make the cars price competitive. And so buyer subsidies will continue to help that as well.
Biden's plan calls for a network of 500,000 charging stations to be installed this decade and tax incentives and rebates to lower the cost of buying an electric car. Overall, it calls for an investment of about 1% of GDP over the next 8 years. Joel Jaeger is a researcher at the World Resources Institute who's been analyzing stimulus packages around the world throughout the pandemic.
So I've done the rough math, and about half of that $2 trillion are in sectors that I would consider to be under the broad umbrella of green spending,
including sustainable and affordable housing, public transit, railways, and clean power.
If passed, this would be the biggest and most ambitious green investment package in history. It'd be more green spending than any COVID recovery package from any country so far. The only economy that's close to the same level when it comes to green spending is the European Union.
The EU's budget and long-term recovery package is roughly the same size as Biden's proposal, but only about 30% of it is mandated to be climate friendly. Of course, that's already been approved by the EU Parliament. The White House plan will have to go through Congress. It relies on hiking the corporate tax rate for funding, and business groups are already speaking out against it. Biden hopes to pass it by summer, which could mean relying on thin majorities in both houses of Congress to push it through. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
In France, police say they're building a case against an international smuggling ring. The thieves aren't trafficking in drugs or diamonds. They're stealing Legos. The suspects came from Poland, then raided toy stores and brought the Legos back home to sell online. This is far from the first time something like this has happened. Lego thieves have also been known to break into homes. In 2018, Louis, who goes by the online handle Republic Attack, had most of his collection stolen. The YouTuber said they ransacked his house and targeted about $18,000 worth of his plastic bricks.
What's really strange is that they personally come for Legos. I mean, no laptop been stolen. There was a brand new Mac computer. They didn't steal it.
Now, before you think, okay, isn't this quirky? Imagine your favorite hobby, your knitting, baseball cards, whatever. Now, imagine that being taken from you. That's what happened to Louis.
14 years of collection? But now, even with lots of money, I can't rebuild that. My brick's gone. Like, so I'm just stopping.
Poor guy. That story does have a happy ending, though. Lego collectors around the world raised $18,000 for Louis to rebuild. But the bigger problem persists. In recent years, Lego crimes have escalated across the globe. Discontinued models can be worth some serious dough. And for aspiring Lego speculators, there's lots of advice about where to invest.
You know, if I had $10,000 to spend in Lego right now, where would I put my money? There's so many themes.
Talk about is the set number 75895. It's the 1974 Porsche 911 Turbo 3.0. Speed
Champions. In this video, I will cover every single set that is expected to retire in 2020 and provide recommendations on which ones I think are worth your investment dollars.
As for the Lego thieves now prowling around out there, a thought from the online community of collectors: may you step on a Lego barefoot every day of your lives. Now to West Africa and Ghana. That nation has long been looked to as a beacon of stability on the African continent. Ghana was the first sub-Saharan country to gain independence. Ghanaians still pride themselves on their freedoms. But that liberty isn't afforded to everyone. Consider the LGBTQ community there. Recently, public acts of homophobia in Ghana have pushed LGBTQ Ghanaians into the national spotlight. The World's Bianca Hillier reports.
January 31st was supposed to be the start of something new in Ghana. It was the opening ceremony for the country's first ever LGBTQ center. Alex Doncor is the director of LGBT Plus Rights Ghana, the organization running the space.
We wish to create a space for ourselves as a movement to be able to sit down and strategize and mobilize and coordinate resources.
Ghana's LGBTQ community has a history of fighting for freedom, but most of this organizing has been done online for security reasons. So this physical space in Accra signaled new opportunities, but it didn't last long. Moses Fomoning heads up Ghana's National Coalition for Proper Sexual Rights and Family Values and quickly put up a fight.
The presidency and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs and the IGP have every right to investigate the setting up of that office, to close it down immediately and arrest and prosecute those people involved in it.
In the weeks following the LGBTQ center's opening, Fomoning led a campaign to shut down the space. Archbishop Philip Name, president of the Ghana Catholic Bishops Conference, quickly echoed the stance on local television.
This practice is completely foreign to our Ghanaian culture. And the law should be framed in such a way that it is punishable in a very severe way.
Less than 1 month after the center opened, the building's landlord arrived with police in tow. A member of LGBT Plus Rights Ghana recorded the scene from down the street.
You guys, I just go to the office and look. There is police and there is a car. What are we going to do? Oh my God, you guys.
The Ghana Police Service couldn't be reached for comment, but LGBT Plus Rights Ghana says police raided and shut down the space without reason. Same-sex relationships are illegal in Ghana. And days after the closure, Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo, made clear that's not changing anytime soon.
It will not be under the presidency of Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo that same-sex marriage will be legalized in Ghana. It will never happen in my time as president.
This rhetoric continued for weeks and into the month of March, when Ghana celebrates its Independence Day.
At long last, the battle has ended.
Since 1957, March 6th has been a toast to how far the country has come. But this year, queer Ghanaians couldn't join in the celebration. Danny Bediako is the deputy director for the African Equality Center in Ghana.
For the first time ever, Independence Day was silent within the LGBT community in Ghana. Because within the streets, within our communities and the small towns and villages, people are being targeted for different homophobic attacks.
Bediako says Ghana won't be truly free as long as groups like Moses Fowamoning's National Coalition hold so much power. He called Fowamoning, quote, Ghana's biggest homophobe. And he pointed out his close ties to the media and parliament. Those connections were solidified last week.
We have formed a group in parliament today.
At a national prayer rally, politician Emmanuel Kwasi Bedzra said 30 members of Ghana's parliament have formed the Believers Against LGBTQ Plus Alliance. With Fowamoning's support, they want to explicitly criminalize LGBTQ identities and advocacy by the end of 2021. Bedzra said he's confident the bill will pass without resistance because no MPs have, quote, owned up to being queer themselves.
So for me, I believe that in parliament, there is none of them. And they will support the bill when we present it.
The size and authority of this group is alarming to Danny Bediako.
It is the biggest threat that we have been hit by. And now we think the worst is yet to come. Because when you see how they talk, when you hear them making statements in public, it's more of you wait and see what we are going to do to you.
Alex Donkor from LGBT Plus Rights Ghana shares that fear.
Obviously, it's very hurtful. It is very sad. And it is very dangerous.
Donkor is working to make sure queer Ghanaians can stand up for themselves safely. For an online protest today, LGBT Plus Rights Ghana is advising people to follow strict security measures, including creating new Twitter accounts, turning location services off, and working through a VPN. But despite this rise in threats and homophobia, Ghana's LGBTQ community refuses to stand down. Inema Ajipong is a queer Ghanaian with the group Silent Majority Ghana. They've noticed people being out and proud like never before.
That unapologetic gayness, unapologetic queerness is really coming to the forefront. Because for so long, part of the conversation has been, you know, you don't belong here, get out, go somewhere else. And I think that queer Ghanaians are saying, hey, actually, we do belong here. This is our home.
That confidence is exemplified in a new song, out today on Transgender Day of Visibility, by Ghana's first transgender musician, Angel Maxine.
Say why I live my life like this. I'm sorry, oh, I'm sorry.
Actually, I'm not sorry.
The lyrics go on to say anyone you know could be part of the LGBTQ community. They're still Ghanaian, and they're definitely not sorry. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
On this year's International Transgender Day of Visibility, President Biden made history by issuing the first presidential proclamation recognizing the occasion. On that note, we want to highlight more of the transgender artists on the global airwaves today, starting with Arca, a Venezuelan producer of experimental pop music. This song is part of her fourth studio album, Kick One, which got a Grammy nomination this year for Best Dance or Electronic Album. Over in Dublin, Ireland, non-binary producer Alexis is spinning pulsating hyper-pop tracks. This song called Rush is the opening single on their upcoming album. And moving on from pop tracks, we'll end today in Mexico City, where singer-songwriter La Bruja de Texcoco breaks gender norms while incorporating traditional Mexican music into her work. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow. Ooh.
descontrolar. Solo recuerda que...